Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And we have Taylor Nakagawa with us. He is a... Actually, Taylor, what is your title?
I'm an audience analyst here at TechCrunch. It's kind of a hybrid position, but I work a little bit of social, work a little with editorial. But thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. And this is the podcast where we discuss the week's streaming and entertainment news, and we review one new movie or show on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon. This week, we're going to review To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is a new movie on Netflix. But let's start with the news. This is actually a story that, Jordan, that you were one of three people who worked on, which is about Amazon potentially buying the Landmark theater chain.
Yeah, it's important to note that sometimes at TechCrunch, we all get really excited about one story, and so we all write it together. It's not often, but it happens. So Amazon, well, Bloomberg reported that Amazon has put itself in the running to buy Landmark. We have not confirmed that. We've not been able to independently confirm that. And so the angle we took, which I think is the right angle to take, is why would this or would this not make sense? And I think we all kind of came to the consensus, wrote it with Ingrid and Brian Heater, and came to the consensus that makes a lot of sense for Amazon to make this acquisition. There's the piece that Amazon has obviously got Amazon Studios, and it's working on its own original content. It's working on media distribution in general, books, television, movies, music. So this is one piece of that puzzle. It kind of gives them a little bit of a different kind of leverage when it comes to working on buying stuff that it doesn't make itself or distributing stuff that it does make itself. And then in the same vein, there's the issue of how Amazon is approaching retail. And thus far, they've made it really easy. All the stuff that you wish you didn't have to go spend money on or wish you didn't have to be active in spending money on and, you know, go out into the world to get, they've made really easy to buy. But there's like this whole category of stuff that you want to go out and spend your money on, right? Like watching movies is one of them. Going out to bars, clubs, concerts, sport games, dining out, you know, these are all forms of retail that Amazon doesn't really have a whole lot of control over. The Whole Foods deal was, you know, a good example of it. They have, and if I'm just rambling, go ahead and shut me up. But
no, they're doing good.
With Amazon Whole Foods, you know, there were two pieces to that. One was, yeah, we've got this massive digital subscription business, Prime, right? 100 million users. Right. And how many things can we sell under that, right? Either at a discount or some sort of special perks to having Prime. How many things can we sell online through this Prime membership? And then the other thing is how many, you know, how much can we control in the real world? And so I think the movie theater thing makes a lot of sense because you have people coming out and spending their money through Amazon instead of someone else, which is just key number one. And then you also have the idea of like, you have the idea of selling other shit, right? Like how much money is made in a movie theater that's not on the ticket itself? Tons, right? Whether it's concessions and
right, like popcorn and.
Yeah, and you could see how Amazon could actually sell other stuff. It creates an ad platform, right? I mean, there's certain ads you can't get away from. I always think of the New York subway ads as one of them, where it's like, even if you don't want to be advertised to, you're on the subway, you're not doing anything else, what else are you going to look at? You're going to look at those ads, and I read them all for some reason. And the movie theater is the same way, right? You're sitting there waiting for the movie to start. So there's a whole spate of reasons why this acquisition would make sense. We don't know how real it is yet. We just have the Bloomberg reporting, but I think it's an interesting move, and I'd be excited to see what else Amazon does in this kind of experiential retail world in terms of acquisitions.
Yeah, I mean, especially with MoviePass bleeding money and AMC, you know, competing to have its own, you know, subscription business. I mean, I think Amazon really fits into that whole space as well of not even having to worry about buying tickets, you know, just having a subscription service ready for people and have it recurring every single month.
Well, and Amazon could do it so much more cost effectively. Like, the price of a new user is 10 times the price of an existing user, right? So, like, think about bringing 100 million people. You wouldn't have to give them, you know, unlimited, you know, movies for 10 bucks. You could say you're already part of Prime, go to one free movie a month. And even that is enough to kind of get the ball rolling. So, I don't know. It's really interesting.
Well, and I think that the other issue for MoviePass has been because they don't own the theaters and they don't necessarily have many relationships yet with the movie studios. Anytime you're buying a ticket through MoviePass, they're just buying the ticket for you, which is why they're having so many financial problems right now. But if, you know, Amazon potentially owns the movie theater, at least in some, I mean, this is not
or
necessarily.
Or the movie, right?
Right, owns the movie and or the movie theater. We should know, I mean, Landmark, I think you guys wrote it owns 56 theaters, which is like 268 screens. So it's a decent sized chain, but it's not like, like it's the largest chain that's focused on indie movies. It's not like AMC or one of the ones that's just like on every block in every city.
Yeah. And if you think about the money that Amazon has, the money that Amazon makes, I mean, this is chump change for them. You know what I mean? Comparatively. So I don't think the price of Landmark is going to be anything compared to what they're spending money on right now. So yeah, I think it's an interesting play. I'm excited to see if it's legit or not. And even if it's not, I'm just excited to see kind of, now that I've been thinking about it, how Amazon approaches these different things. There's so much cross marketing when you have that much leverage across so many different industries. There's just so much cross play there that should be really fun to watch. So
it feels like a movie theater is like the perfect venue to bring all those physical resources that Amazon has together with Whole Foods. I mean, imagine getting like Whole Foods quality food at a movie theater and having like an autonomous angle of you know, picking up popcorn or something like that. It just seems like a perfect culmination of all Amazon resources into one place.
Yeah, and the way that the approach that Amazon's taking to retail with like, you know, check out on your own and these different kind of pieces that make it feel very much like it's 2020, I think is pretty cool. And yeah, I'm interested. We'll see how it goes. But
well, and I think it also ties into one of the other stories I wanted to talk about, which isn't primarily a streaming story, but has the streaming angle, which is Crazy Rich Asians is coming out, or came out a couple days ago as we record this on Friday. But in that, sort of, there's been all this press about the movie, and obviously the big thing about it is just this Asian, primarily Asian American cast hasn't happened in decades, at least not for a film that's set, you know, in the present day. But the other aspect of it was apparently Netflix really wanted this movie to the point where they were offering the filmmakers a ton of money and also wanted to make the full, because there's three books. It's based on this book, Crazy Rich Asians, but there's two sequels. They wanted to make all three movies, and ultimately the filmmakers decided to go with a less lucrative deal with Warner Brothers, the reason they're talking about it is because I think they're basically saying, we think that you still can't replicate the cultural impact of having a movie in theaters, like having Black Panther in theaters and having Get Out in theaters, like, and seeing that it's a financial success in a way that you don't see with Netflix, because it just sort of, you know, it just comes out there. Maybe people talk about it, maybe they don't, but like, you don't know exactly how well it did. Like, changes Hollywood if the movie does well, in a way that just is not going to happen with a Netflix film. That could happen with an Amazon film, because those already do come out in at least art house theaters, but there's something about that, even as everything has moved to this sort of streaming landscape, there's still something about movie theaters that that can like make for this huge impact.
Yeah, and I totally see where he's coming from. It's something about like the way that people talk about movies that are in theaters is just so natural. And I think even when you think about the hype that's generated around a new, and I think Netflix also generates way more hype around television shows than it does around movies.
That's also like, true. Yeah.
I can't think of a Netflix original movie that has had hype that's even remotely similar to some of their big shows, you know, Orange is the New Black, etc. Like the conversations around those shows can last months, right? Like they're still TV writers who are writing about that stuff. And it's just not the same with their movies. It feels like the movies are small beans, whatever the word I'm trying to say is.
Yeah, and I think they're trying to change that, but it hasn't happened yet. And
even their big ones, like Bright, right? Like Bright, we didn't talk about. Like,
was that the one with Will Smith?
Yeah.
The one with like Will Smith and the aliens. Yeah, I thought that that got a lot of hype, and it never really lived up to it. But got to give the directors and the producers for Crazy Rich Asians a lot of kudos for, you know, taking a huge bet on putting this on the big screen. But I saw Crazy Rich Asians last night in theaters, and it really did feel like, you know, a larger than life event. Seeing everyone coming out for it on a weekday, having it being released, you know, on a Wednesday night, was pretty special. And, you know, I thought I was really blown away by the story of it all, by how it really, you know, dealt with this whole theme of like dual identity, having the main character being Asian American. I thought it was a really good time overall. And I think the best part about it is that it hits kind of these traditional tropes of romantic comedies as a whole, but it brings, you know, a really fresh approach to it all. And I thought it was amazing.
Well, Taylor, so you, I think people can probably guess that you are an Asian American yourself. And I think one of the things people have talked about is, you know, this sort of feeling of like when you go in to see a movie and because of like what it represents, you kind of just need it to be good, or like you're almost like, I don't even care if it's good, I just want it to do well. Did you feel some of that pressure when you went to see it?
A little bit. I think I went into it thinking that it would just be kind of this typical romantic comedy, and having the presence of a fully Asian American cast would push it over the edge. But really, when you break it down, it's just it's a really well put together movie. I think that the pacing of it, the way that it introduces characters, the way that it reveals really how rich, so to say, the main character is in the story is really well done. I think the supporting characters around Constance Wu and the other actor, who I'm completely forgetting his name right now, is really well done. And I think that
Henry Golding,
yeah, he was like an actor that one of the accountants for the entire production found on Instagram being a travel agent or something in Singapore.
And travel host, yeah, not host. Quite so remote, but yeah, he'd never acted before.
But yeah, I mean, I think that there was kind of this feeling that, you know, regardless of what was on screen, that what we were seeing was, you know, significant. But I think that the movie really came through in spades in bringing a really original approach to, you know, a romantic comedy that has been done so many times in the same way. I thought it was incredible.
Yeah, and I think also just like, I haven't seen Crazy Rich Asians. I'm excited to see it. But I do think that we're going to see a little bit of a resurgence in the rom-com. I think people have figured out what does and doesn't make the rom-com work, right? Like, it's about really well-written, interesting characters. It's about relatability, and it's about chemistry. And for a really long time, the rom-com was stuck in this like formula where they would just like put in like just plug and play famous actors and actresses and just do the same kind of formulaic thing over and over and over again. And I think we're seeing people take a fresh approach to them and just remember what it's all about, which is great characters and great chemistry and relatability. And I'm excited to see Crazy Rich Asians. I think we got some of that with the setup in terms of like a good solid rom-com, and I think we have that today too with the movie that we're reviewing.
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest strength of Crazy Rich Asians as a whole is it's not about falling in love. It's not about, you know, attaining a certain level of class, but I think that, you know, the real core of the movie is about identity and about the main character trying to balance her past with, you know, the person that she's being introduced with, the culture that she's being introduced with, and how, you know, she's able to reconcile with her own past and connect with those around her in order to, you know, build a new life with her partner.
Cool. Well, it sounds like some of these issues will come up again when we talk about our review this week. But before that, let's just touch really briefly on one other piece of news, which is about Kenya Barris, who is the creator of Black-ish and Grown-ish, and also was one of the writers on Girls Trip, just signed an exclusive deal with Netflix. And so this sort of follows up on both Shonda Rhimes and Ryan Murphy had signed these enormous exclusive deals. Shonda Rhimes' deal was supposed to be worth $100 million. Ryan Murphy's was supposed to be worth $300 million. Netflix is usually not like releasing the, you know, the dollar value. But the Hollywood Reporter says this one's not quite as much money, but is like in like close to $100 million. And so it's just like another sign of like how Netflix is, you know, now really getting aggressive about like snapping up these successful Hollywood showrunners. Have you guys seen Black-ish?
Maybe one or two episodes.
Yeah, I have not seen Black-ish, but I have seen Girls Trip, who I see that Kenya Barris was a writer for and was a huge fan of that movie. So excited to see what he can bring to Netflix.
Yeah, I liked Girls Trip. I saw that.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. I feel bad, but I know our colleague Megan Rose Dickey is also super, super excited about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's honestly astounding how much money Netflix has and is spending, right, on content. Like, if you just think about it, I mean, they're outspending these networks that have been around for 50 years, right? And it just kind of boggles the mind a little bit. And it's worth it, right? Because here we are talking about all these shows and movies and stuff. So, yeah, I think it's pretty crazy.
Cool. Well, should we move on to our review then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
I liked this movie.
Tell us more about... so again, this is To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is like a teen romance movie, and it's based on a young adult novel by Jenny Han. Jordan, it sounds like you liked it.
I did, yeah. So like, just quick synopsis without any spoilers. The protagonist here, her name's Laura Jean, and she is one of three sisters. And through a series of events, she has written these five love letters to boys that she's known growing up or whatever in her high school, whatever, and they're love letters. And through a series of events, those letters get sent and mailed, and the guys receive them. And it's kind of a story of how she deals with that, how she approaches love and kind of opening herself up to the idea of falling in love. It's a family story. It's a little bit rom-com, a little bit young adult. It's got kind of a lot happening there, but it's just also, I feel like they took like a pretty simple premise and turned it into something that is really, really fun to watch and really sweet. It just kind of had me saying aw every few minutes. So, it's just like an easy laid back movie to watch. I really liked it.
Although it's interesting because it almost feels like there's like at least two different like premises in the film, that because it starts out, like you said, with this story about the letters getting sent. But then fairly quickly, it kind of has this other high concept, which is about Lara Jean basically pretending to be dating somebody else, which is like a very classic kind of rom-com setup where like two people are like put in a position where they have to pretend to be in love with each other. And then,
yeah,
sort of inevitably the feelings develop. But so it was weird that like it started out as this one kind of like concept, I thought, and then it kind of went in a different direction than I was expecting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I like that like unexpected bit, because when we start the movie, she does have feelings for someone, and it kind of transforms throughout. And you don't really know which way she's going to go or which way she's going to land. But I think like the overarching thing, which I don't think was expected in either of those plots, was how she feels about herself, right? Like and you hear this is something that is not rocket science to anybody. We know this. When you open yourself up to love, you open yourself up to getting hurt, right? And I think as a teenager, especially as one who maybe, I mean, this main character, Laura Jean, isn't necessarily like an outcast by any stretch, but she's not super popular. She just kind of keeps to herself. She does her own thing. She's got her own little friends. She's got her family, and she doesn't take any risks. And so she doesn't reap any rewards or any of the kind of the bad stuff that can happen when you take a risk. So it's about her figuring out what's worth it and what's not. And And I like that. I think that's a good kind of message for young people. You gotta take risks sometimes. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, but you gotta take those risks.
So Taylor, I know you were not as big
a fan. I was not a fan of it. And I understand the point that you guys are making. I think the messaging of taking risks and putting yourself out there to, you know, fall in love and be hurt due to, you know, those choices is very apparent. But I just felt that the majority of the characters in this movie were pretty dry. I thought that the writing in of itself was the number one thing that was holding it back from being, you know, a solid movie. And I kept, you know, at every single scene, I was rooting for Laura Jean, who's played by Lana Condor, who I think is really solid. I think that her acting really carries the movie as a whole, but I think that all the other characters around her are just really, you know, one-dimensional. They don't do too much to drive, you know, the plot forward. And when you watch the trailer of this movie, you really think, okay, great, like, we're going to have, you know, this one girl torn between all these letters that are being sent out to these three different boys, and I'm really interested in how all three of them are going to work around her and her working through, you know, these issues. But, you know, all the two other boys that get these letters really are kind of pushed to the side. And one of them comes back near the end of the movie. But I was hoping for a little bit more as far as the characters that surround Lara Jean, and never really got that throughout the entire movie, and felt that, you know, the entire watching experience as a whole was just kind of bland.
Wow, I like could not disagree more. I thought that the characters, I hear what you're saying with the writing, like it could be a bit dry at certain points, but I also think that is far more, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, even with myself, but like, look at something like Dawson's Creek, where all of those teenagers are supposedly like, I don't know, the 180 IQ. They're all like so smart and so clever and witty, and every line of dialogue is just so unbelievable, right? Like, I'm not saying that teenagers don't speak like adults. They do. But like, that level of witty banter is just so unrealistic. And I felt like this was a little bit closer to the reality, which is, yeah, they can talk like adults, they can have a couple clever moments, witty banter with one another, but at the end of the day, they're all just like kind of teenagers trying to figure it out. They are a little cliche, you know? And I think it's cool that it took a turn for not being about these letters as much as it was about her figuring herself out. Like, it's a coming of age story. It's not like a plot twist type thing. You know what I mean?
True. Yeah, I understand that. But I think that the whole element of, you know, their mom not being around, her older sister leaving. I wanted a little bit more of the family dynamics playing a part of that. And once the letters are out, I think the whole family of itself kind of gets pushed to the side. And was hoping to see, you know, her grow, her relationships, you know, with her family. And it really just turns into just this back and forth with this one boy. I just wasn't, you know, a big fan of that. Felt that it was really repetitive in every scene and every step that she was taking forward.
Didn't feel that way because I guess I see what you're saying, that it's like in some ways a fairly, once you realize that it's not going to be as much about those letters as you might think initially, like everything else that happens after that kind of follows mostly in the direction that you would expect. But like, I thought like it was executed really well, and I think particularly I just liked the two lead characters. Like we mentioned, Lana Condor as Lara Jean, and then also this actor, Noah Centineo, I think, as Peter. And I just thought like together they just had this like really like great dynamic. It feels weird talking about like high school characters in this way, but like, yeah. I did think like they were like really strong romantic leads. Like that was like, to me, like the thing that made the movie. I agree that like towards the end, I mean, I liked that some of the family stuff came back, but I thought some of the romantic aspect of it was not as good, just because I think once you kind of have your like two romantic leads get together, like they've been kind of like kept apart and they kind of get together, and then there's like not really that much that can happen in the movie, because like, I mean, like you said, like Jordan, like it's about developing her character too, but everything, like the last 20 minutes also just felt kind of like anticlimactic to me.
So I agree that the last 15 minutes or so were a little bit anticlimactic. There wasn't a lot happening plot-wise. Like it all kind of fell into your lap the way you expected it to. But I also feel like the letter part of the story was the least realistic part and the least relatable part. I actually think the relationship between Peter and Laura Jean was like, and I don't know, it's been whatever, 10 years since I've been in high school, longer, Jesus, 12 years. but at the same time, it feels pretty relatable that they would have these miscommunications. They would be kind of trying to pull a fast one on everyone and, you know, pretend they're in this relationship and then slowly grow feelings for each other. And the way that they approach that, the way they realize that, it all felt very kind of, I hesitate to use the word realistic because nothing's realistic, but like relatable. It felt like it could happen. And I liked that about it. As anticlimactic as it was, it felt like true-ish to it to an extent. Like I felt the genuineness of it.
The question of realism is an interesting one to me because that did, I mean, because you're right that it feels a little bit more realistic than a lot of the other high school comedies and romances that I've seen. But I do wonder now, like, as soon as you say that, I'm like, how often have people pretended to be boyfriend and girlfriend in college for, like, social gain? I hope it does happen. Like, just I just want I that to be a thing that happens. Yeah.
Yeah, I would think that, I think that whole aspect of it felt really believable. The aspect of them, you know, trying to play off of each other in order to make other people jealous, in order to lift themselves up. But the part about that entire relationship that kept me from really believing it, really cheering for both of them, was the fact that it felt formulaic. All right, we're going to do this. We're going to, you know, pass notes to each other in the lunchroom. And then, of course, like the other girlfriend's going to come in and be jealous. We're going to go to the ski trip. And something's going to happen. And of course, like that one girlfriend's going to step in at the wrong time. And the repetitiveness of all that, the ability to just guess when the bad person's going to come in was really what was bothering me the entire time.
Yeah, I think also, though, that's just like chalked up to the category of the film, rom-com.
That's true,
like,
yeah.
It's really, really easy to predict, like, oh, things are going too well right now. Like, something bad is going to happen. You know, like, that is really right. Easy. And I don't think that's what makes a rom-com necessarily. Like, that roller coaster is almost necessary to some extent. What makes it interesting is whether or not we buy into these characters. Sounds to me, Taylor, like you didn't. Like, you weren't impressed with them. But, like, I just felt, even though it wasn't the funniest writing in the world, it wasn't the sweetest, most romantic writing in the world, it wasn't even the most original writing in the world, it just felt very, like, grounded, I guess.
Right, like, no one felt, like, they all, like, I mean, obviously it's a movie, so, like, it's all actually people who are in their early 20s, and they're all incredibly good-looking, but there was still this feeling of just, like, everyday life. And that, even when things went bad, I liked that it was, they went bad in this relatively low-key way. There wasn't this, like, giant crisis they had to deal with. It was, you know, relatively small stuff. But then what I think a lot of high school movies have to do to be effective is, like, to both acknowledge that, like, the stuff that happens to you when you're in high school, I mean, there are obviously going to be exceptions, but, like, in general, in these circumstances, is not going to be, like, huge earth-shattering stuff, except to you it is. And so, like...
And they conveyed that well, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Totally. Like, they did a good job of, like, there's a moment where the shit kind of hits the fan and everything comes out into the open. And it's with, like, these people. It's not in a lunchroom cafeteria situation. It's not in front of the whole school. I mean, there are a couple of those moments. But the real moment where things kind of go bad for our main character are, it's a controlled environment. It's a small group of people. And it's real emotion that we see. And it's not, you know, there's no flowery speeches about it. It just kind of happens. And it feels like a big deal to her. But we know as viewers, it's not really. It'll all be okay. It'll all be forgiven. And that's kind of how things play out. And I liked that about it.
One other thing that I think is also just worth pointing out at the movie that I liked, but they don't make a big deal out of, is the fact that Lara Jean comes from this, what is presumably sort of a biracial family with... an Asian American mother and a white father, and like the kids are all presumably Hapa, but there's specific details where the dad is like trying to cook Korean food at home, But, like, it's not, like, a thing that people make a big deal out of. It's not something that, like, actually affects, you know, how other people see her. Which I think is, like, interesting, you know, just having this come out the same week as Crazy Rich Asians. And so you have one romantic comedy where it's, like, the fact that it's Asian characters is, like, so central to what it is. And then you can also have one, like, To All the Boys I've Loved Before, where that's an aspect of it, but it's really not the main element.
Yeah. I was thinking about that in the context of Crazy Rich Asians, given that I knew we would talk about it today. And it just seemed like that it was something that was just, yeah, not at the forefront of the movie in any way at all. So I thought it was good.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely applaud them for how natural it felt throughout the entire movie. Do wish they would have touched a little bit more on her identity, because I feel like in high school that's like one part, especially for me being an Asian American, of like dealing with this dual identity and trying to, I guess, fit in with certain groups of people while also staying true to your cultural roots. But the movie throughout definitely felt very natural in how they approached the biracial aspect of their family.
So I'm curious, like, I mean, we were talking about just about like kind of our expectations for romantic comedies. And I think like high school romantic comedies are this sort of specific, you know, subgenre within it. And there's like this period, I think, like in the like late 90s, early aughts, when there were like a whole bunch of them, like, I think partly like chasing after the success of Bring It On and She's All That. And to me, this really, I mean, I think this is a much more grounded version of those stories, but it also like reminded me of the things that I liked about those movies. Were you guys fans of like those kinds of high school romances?
Yeah, I think there were some of them that were really great, and then there were some that weren't so great. And I think as time went on, those high school rom-coms became more and more kind of ridiculous and outlandish and less grounded. She's All That is an awesome movie, but it is like not even remotely believable.
Right, there's that whole dance scene with Usher.
Yeah, like, there's just so many pieces of it that are silly, right? Like, Clueless, I think, is another example. Like, such a good movie, but also, like, really? Like, I think this kind of took... And then we moved into, like, the Twilight realm, right? Like, all these sci-fi, right. Like, it gets even more ridiculous. This is like a good kind of like return to the roots, and it felt very grounded. I want to see Love, Simon. I wonder how that fits into the conversation we're having. Have you guys seen that?
I've not seen Love, Simon. Have you seen Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl? That's more of like a, has more of like a morbid tone to it. But I think that what makes those kinds of movies so strong is the presence of really strong side characters, and how these side characters really play off of each other and teach the main character lessons that drive them through the entire plot. And that, to me, is what was the missing link to this, to All the Boys That I've Loved Before. And while I get that the aspect, the focus is really on her dealing with her own issues, I wish that there was a little bit more from her younger sister, a little bit more from the people around her that could help her grapple with these issues that she's working with, and also teach her some lessons along the way.
I will admit that the younger sister didn't totally work for me, that she was like, I mean, at the beginning I thought I liked her, but like as the movie went on, she was a little bit too precocious and like kind of like always knowing the right thing to do.
Yeah, right. She kind of just like released the letters out there and just kind of faded into the background and didn't really show up until like the third act of the movie.
Damn, Taylor, give it away. Yeah, I don't know how I felt about either of the sisters, to be honest. And, like, the sisterhood relationship almost felt the least realistic to me. Like, but I don't know either, because they lost their mother, right? So, like, maybe that just forges a different bond. But I feel like high school-age siblings, like, pretty rare that they are quite that close and rely on each other that much, but it makes more sense in the context of like needing each other more. I don't really know, but I didn't really care for the sisters as much. I thought the character that played Jen and Jen's cousin, I thought that was like an interesting dynamic. I thought they were both pretty good. I thought both the boys, the main boys were good. And even the kind of supporting role that the one boy who got the letter, who plays more of a friend, the gay one, he was pretty good too. I thought he was funny. It's like just enough, you know what I mean? Like, that's what it felt like. It's just enough other people. Because really, at the end of the day, the people that had my attention and the people I wanted to hear from more were Laura Jean and Peter.
Yeah, I agree with that. That, you know, I understand that, like, a lot of times people talk about the side characters. And I think there were decent side characters, but they weren't, like, the highlight of the movie. But in some ways, I think if your leads are good, then that's a lot less important.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in a rom-com. I think, are we good? Anything else to add?
Well, let me just remind our listeners before they go that they can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app of their choice. If you enjoy it, it'd be great if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And thank you all for listening. And thanks, Taylor, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Cool. Thanks, Taylor.